Can everyone hear me? Okay, great. Thank you. I'm Arnie Olson. I'm a partner with E3. And before I get started, I want to recognize some others at E3 that have helped a lot throughout the process. Anna Maleva is here. She's a senior consultant at E3, and she's here to answer any hard questions that you guys have that I can't answer. There's a couple other folks back at E3, Amber Mahone and Nick Schlag in particular. Many of you know them, have really been working hard on this study over the last several weeks. On the slide two, this is our you are here slide. I'm here to talk about the portfolios, both of renewable and conventional resources that we'll be modeling and giving over to Brattle to do the production simulation modeling with. My talk is outlined, it says slide 11. The slide numbering is a little bit funky, so Patrick, I'll do my best to orient you to where we are. My slide says number 11 here. I went from number 2 to number 11. Anyway, my talk is organized as follows. I'm going to just give you a brief overview of how we develop the portfolios, talk about some of the key data inputs, and these really do make an impact on the results. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time there. Walk you through the results. There's a lot of tables with numbers at the end, which you'll have time to study kind of in the, on your own time, but I'll try to walk you through those as best as I can. And then, of course, we're looking for stakeholder input. So at the end, I think there'll be some time for you to provide some input. And slide 12 here shows, just in case you couldn't think of anything to say to us, here are some suggestions of areas where you might want to weigh in. Availability of in-state and out-of-state resources. What we've done with respect to assumption of resources available for REC purchases for California utilities, quantities and types of storage by scenario, other resources that we've added, cost assumptions, those sorts of things. And we'll come back to this at the end of the talk. Okay, just a few minutes now on how we developed the portfolios. On to slide 14. Developed a new model for the purpose of developing these portfolios for the CalISO. It's called the Renewable Energy Solutions Model, or RESOLVE. And what RESOLVE does is it selects the least cost combination of resources, renewable resources and conventional resources, to meet, various different constraints, energy constraints, capacity constraints, and of course, most importantly, RPS constraints. And you could put a CO2 constraint on there as well if you wanted to, although we haven't. What we've found, we've looked at renewable resource portfolios over the last several years. What we found is that as you get closer and closer to 50%, that the integration issues become pretty significant, and it becomes harder and harder to look at renewables in isolation from what you're doing with the rest of the system. So you really need to start considering what solutions you're adding on to the renewable portfolio, because that can make a big impact. Do you have storage available to you or not? If so, your portfolio tends to tilt more heavily towards solar. And what other solutions do you have available to you to help integrate those renewables? We find that has an impact on the portfolio that least costs. So we wanted to develop a model that would look at all those things in combination and pick a least cost combination of resources to meet all these constraints at the same time. The way that RESOLVE does this, and I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail, is it goes through and there's a dispatch model, which I'll talk about, so it minimizes the operating costs plus the sum of all of the investment costs, all investments in all of the renewable resources and all of the other resources. So we'll go over this in some more detail. There's kind of two major potential effects of regional integration that we want to use the model to test. And we've broken these down into two categories. One is just on operations alone, and the second one is on procurement. So first effect is, even if California continued on kind of a business-as-usual trajectory with respect to renewable procurement policy, so we wanted to continue building largely in-state resources, largely solar resources, we think there may be benefits from regional operations just in providing integration services to that portfolio of resources. So kind of the same business-as-usual portfolio, and what's the effect of regional operations, regional integration on the integration of renewables and kind of the production costs, and does that change the portfolio a little bit, and what are the benefits of just looking at the operations kind of in isolation? Then there's a second piece that says, well, look, if we have a west-wide grid now, there are very high-quality wind resources in the Rocky Mountain areas and very high-quality solar resources in the Southwest. And so separately, we want to test the effect of what would be the least cost portfolio if you were picking from renewable resources all around the West for the benefit of California ratepayers. So we're testing these two effects kind of separately. And so in answer to the earlier question about the product content categories, really, in number one, we're not assuming any change to those definitions at all. We're still procuring the way that we've always done in California. Number two now, we're testing this and kind of assuming in number two that all of the West becomes eligible for product content category one. And, you know, it's really, we can pick from the best resources all around the West. So we're kind of testing those two pieces separately. We have three scenarios that we've developed to do that. The first is, of course, a kind of business as usual reference case, counterfactual scenario. This is, again, procurement is largely from in-state resources, although not exclusively, as I'll talk about. There are some out-of-state resources available in this scenario, but relatively limited. And there's no regional market here to help with renewable integration issues. Scenario number two is the one that I referred to on the previous slide. This is now regional market operations, but effectively business as usual policies with respect to renewable procurement. And number three now is just throw the whole thing open. It's regional market for operations and West-wide procurement of resources for the benefit of California ratepayers. Now, business as usual is, as anyone who's been following these studies and done them as much as we have, you probably already know that the business as usual case is the hardest one to model. You know, it's very easy to design a model that does west-wide optimization. All the production cost models, that's what they want to do, west-wide, optimize everything, right? The hard part is, what does our current system look like? You know, how can you make a model reflect all the friction and all the bilateral arrangements, contracts that have been signed, that have been in place for many, many years? How can you make a model, you know, simulate that world? That's very, very difficult. In particular, we think that under the current system of bilateral trading in the West, that there's limits to how much resources in other areas can be brought to bear to help with renewable integration challenges that California is facing. And there's a couple of reasons for this, which I've listed on the slide. There really are actually many, many more than what I've listed here. Primary one is that in the West, we have 38 balancing authorities, as Keith mentioned. Each of those balancing authorities has its own obligation under NERC to operate its system within the bounds that are acceptable with NERC control performance standards. So those balancing areas have to have their own resources at their command to, you know, provide the ramping services, by the regulation, meet all the demands that are placed on their system subject to those NERC control performance standards. So they're going to be very conservative in their reliance on imports, particularly variable imports from a neighboring jurisdiction. So we think that's a very real constraint on the ability of those regions to accept what might be, you know, surplus generation that California can't use that comes about because of our heavy reliance on solar under a 50% RPS. There's other friction in the bilateral system, you know, just the way that power is traded kind of day ahead in blocks, the way the transmission is scheduled. Again, this restricts the ability of these other jurisdictions, these neighboring balancing authorities, to help us with our renewable integration challenges. With the convention that has been in place over the last few years in California for modeling these restrictions is really just to put kind of a hard cap on how much renewable power can be exported from California. Because we've never really seen, you know, real conditions where California has been exporting thousands and thousands of megawatts of power. And so there's some question about just how much power our neighboring jurisdictions could accept. But we don't know exactly how much. So in order to make sure that we're testing kind of the full range here, we developed three different alternatives for our business as usual scenario to make sure we're not relying on this one factor to drive a large amount of the benefits. So we have scenario 1A, where we've limited the net exports to 2,000 megawatts. This is consistent with some of the studies that the CalISO has done in the LTPP case, some of the studies that we've done in the past. So that's one scenario. If we limit net exports to 2,000 megawatts, how does that shape the California portfolio of renewable resources? And then there's a couple others. 1B is where we raise that up to 5,000 megawatts. and 1C up to 8,000 megawatts. And again, these are all alternative ways to look at that business as usual scenario so that we can measure the changes that come about due to regional integration against any of these three business as usual cases. And I don't think as a team we know right now which one we think is the right one, so that's why we're kind of interested actually in seeing all three of them. Questions at this point on this? Quickly? Robin?
Good morning, Arnie. Thank you. Robin Smutney-Jones with Iberdrola Renewables. I was wondering if this is the right time to ask what your assumption is relative to the Clean Power Plan?
So that's really an out-of-state issue. You know, through the Clean Power Plan binding on California. My talk, and if I didn't mention it earlier, I'm looking at renewable procurement on behalf of California ratepayers only. So I think, you know, what the Clean Power Plan shakes the rest of the grid. It's a very minor effect on the California renewable portfolio, but I think it's a topic for the production simulation discussion in the afternoon.
Yeah, Robin, we'll cover that a little later when we get into the production class modeling.
I was really looking for questions here on these kind of three scenarios that I've laid out, whether this all makes sense. Antonio?
Hi, Ernie. Antonio Alvarez, PG&E. With respect to the scenarios, are all the scenarios being run for a common operating year, say 2030, 40% reduction in emissions, that sort of thing? Is that?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, what Resolve does, it starts in 2015 and builds out through 2030 and minimizes the sum of the operating costs and the investment costs over that whole period. So all these scenarios are starting in 20. And I'll talk about this more later, but they're all starting in 2015 with a common base, and then you build up from there and add in a least cost fashion.
But you're aiming at that 40% reduction in emission, I'm assuming, right?
Well, what we have in here is the RPS, is the binding targets. We have the RPS increments, you know, requirements, you know, spaced out year over year as they are in the legislation, and that's the main constraint that the model is doing.
The other question I had is with respect to the assumption about commitment and dispatch between the regional scenario and the other scenarios. Is there a difference in the way the system is operated, you know, in terms of commitment and dispatch?
Yeah, maybe let me get to that. I have a couple slides on that. Yeah, Kevin?
Kevin Woodruff, consultant for Terran. How did you come up with the 2,500 and 8,000 megawatt figures? I know they're not arbitrary, but it would be nice to hear some more.
Yeah, so the 2,000 is, if you look at historical data, the largest amount of exports from California to across any of its enterprise in a given hour in one direction that we could find. So it's basically looking back at historical data and saying what's the largest amount of flow out of California that we could see in the historical record. Now, even during that hour, that was to the northwest. We had more power coming in from the southwest than we were exporting to the northwest. This is kind of one direction. This is, you know, when we're trying to figure this out is, you know, how much power could California, we've never seen it, right? So the first place we look is, well, how much have we ever done in the past? This is kind of the most liberal interpretation that we could make of that. Even that, we've never actually seen this much net export from California. And then the 8,000, this is kind of it's very close to the simultaneous physical transmission capability outside of California. So this is kind of the most that anyone could ever imagine.
That's like a rating or something, the 8,000?
Yeah, it's not quite the rating. I mean, there isn't even a rating west to east on this Western River path, right? So.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
We do have a few questions on the phone as well.
What I mostly want to talk about, get questions on right now, is just these scenarios to make sure the scenarios make sense. I have lots of detail on the modeling, which we'll go into. Yeah, go ahead.
Dave Marcus, consultant to Q. Are you going to have any allocation of the 2,500 and 8,000 megawatts in terms of particular paths, or is that only going to be an aggregate binding limit?
Yeah, these are aggregate binding limits. Yeah.
So individual paths will be only limited by physical capability?
That's correct.
Thanks.
Hi, Ellen Wolf for Rosero Consulting, and I think this might be outside the scope of what you want questions on, but is at some point you going to explain what from your work flows over to the production cost modeling? Because I gather that the portfolios are coming from the E3 analysis, but I don't know if it's the same analysis you're talking about or there'll be one portfolio case that's presumed in the production cost modeling.
So at the very least, I don't know if we've nailed down exactly how many cases we're doing. At the very least, there's going to be three cases, one of the scenario ones, a scenario two, and a scenario three case where we take these renewable portfolios, give the profiles to Brattle, and Brattle will model those in their Westwide production simulation model as part of the kind of the underlying conditions where they explore the Westwide dispatch benefits.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think I should probably move on, ma'am. Yeah. Oh, there's one on the phone, you said. Okay. Okay. No. Yeah, let's go ahead and take them.
Okay, Lauren, we're going to go ahead and take the first question in the queue. Just a reminder to please state your name and affiliation.
Hi, this is Bonnie Blair. I represent California Municipal Utilities. In your business as usual scenario, what assumption are you making about the energy imbalance market?
I mean, as it relates to the renewable portfolios, it's really expressed in these export limits. Again, we don't know which of these export limits is the right one to reflect the amount of integration we're already seeing in the imbalance market. I think the effect of it on the renewable portfolios is kind of indicated on this slide. It is going to be an issue with respect to the production simulation modeling is how do we capture the amount of benefits that are already being achieved through the regional integration that we've done and how much more is there left? What's incremental to that? So I think that's probably a better question for the afternoon.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we'll take the next question.
Hi, this is Julia May from Communities for a Better Environment. And regarding the net export limits, we understand that regional sharing can really help us integrate renewables. Question, would your modeling scenarios identify a case where California ended up ramping up its any slack in gas-fired power to export it out of state so that we would end up, increasing our gas use in California rather than in ways that don't exist right now?
This is Keith Casey. Actually, that question will come into play more in the production cost simulations where we actually model the dispatch of the resources with these portfolios, and there'll certainly be a gas dispatch that goes with that that will help inform that question.
Thanks.
Okay, operator, do we have other questions?
Yes, just one more.
Hi, this is Russ Manifel from BPA. I was curious for the net export limits, do those limits apply for all time intervals, or are there any differences for day ahead, 15-minute market, 5-minute market, et cetera?
Yeah, these are for all time, and we don't have that level of operational granularity in the resolve model to go kind of day ahead, hour ahead, 5 minute. This battle will need to incorporate these assumptions also into the production simulation modeling. Okay, I think then I'll move on. The next slide is slide 18, although there's no number on it. Again, I think we've talked about this already, but what the resolve model does is it minimizes the cost of both operation and expansion. So it minimizes fuel costs across the entire footprint that it models, O&M costs, et cetera, and emission costs, plus the sum of any capital costs that are needed for both renewable resources and conventional resources and solutions such as batteries or other forms of energy storage. It doesn't get into the costs of the existing grid, all the fixed costs that are already sunk, although those will be brought back later at the end when we estimate the impact on California ratepayers. Other assumptions, renewables that are curtailed are assumed to be compensated at their full PPA price. So I'll talk about curtailment in a minute, but this is really an investment model where you assume that the cost to build the solar farm or the wind farm is recovered fully, whether you're able to absorb the output from those resources or not, and that turns out to be kind of a key assumption. These next couple of slides just get into a little bit of the operational detail that we have in the resolve model, which really can have a big impact on the portfolio that the model picks. Slide 19 kind of gives you a little bit of a snapshot of how the model looks at an operating day. We take a subset of the potential operating days of each of our year, and we model those using our daily load wind and solar profiles. What you see in the top right is kind of a typical operating day, kind of in the shoulder season. Across the x-axis are the hours of the day, and on the y-axis it's not labeled, but that's megawatts of dispatch. That kind of dark gray area at the bottom is the sum of the minimum generating levels of all of the thermal resources that are committed on that day. And that kind of light gray range on top of it is the full operating range of all those resources that are available. Right, so you can go anywhere from kind of the top of the dark gray to the top of the light gray. And you can see at night, the model wants to operate those thermal resources kind of right in the middle, maintaining both headroom to provide upward services and footroom to provide downward services. In the middle of the day, there's a lot of solar that comes online. And probably on this day, we're actually are curtailing solar due to overgeneration. So what it does on that day is it runs its thermal resources all the way down to the minimum levels that are needed for reliability. You can see there's no footroom left on those thermal resources on that day. That then implies that the downward services are being provided by renewables or storage or some other non-thermal generation. In fact, you can see now on the bottom slide, the bottom picture there, this is the dispatch of our batteries on that day. And you can see the batteries are charging heavily, almost up to their maximum during during that middle of the daytime when we have surplus solar power available. So surplus solar power is a theme, and it really shapes a lot of what we do with respect to investment in renewables and the benefits of solutions such as storage, such as flexible loads, such as regional integration. This next slide kind of walks through that conceptually, is that Resolve picks the optimal portfolio, again, of renewables, of storage, and of the other solutions, because now the system is complicated enough at 50% that you have to really bring in these other solutions to get a good answer. So this is now three different snapshots of the same operating day. Okay, on the this is slide 20 for those of you on the phone. On the bottom left is kind of a typical operating day. The gray area is the thermal generation. The green area is the renewable generation. The black is the base load that sits at the bottom that you can't move. You see on this day we have a lot of excess solar, a lot of overgeneration on that day. Okay, if you don't implement other solutions, then you have to just curtail that solar. You can't absorb all of the power that's available because your system isn't flexible enough. From a policy perspective, to meet the RPS, that means that you have to overbuild the renewable portfolio. You have to build more wind and more solar to make up for the power that you weren't able to absorb that was curtailed. Right? That's kind of the base case, you know, underlying solution is you have to overbuild because you have a meet, and if you don't, then you simply don't comply. So the model assumes that you comply, and the default solution is to overbuild the renewable portfolio. Of course, that's expensive, right? And, you know, we're building resources where we can't use them all, but it's not infinitely expensive, and solutions are expensive as well, right? So if you look at the right-hand panel now on the bottom, this is the case where we've built enough storage to absorb all of the overgeneration on that day. As you can imagine, to absorb every last megawatt hour of overgeneration takes a lot of batteries. That's a lot of storage, right? So the top graph kind of shows you how many megawatts of storage. This was for kind of a smaller toy system. We had 3,000 megawatts of renewables on that day. To build enough storage to absorb all of them, we had to build an extra 2,000 megawatts worth of storage capability. So that's obviously very expensive, right? So the optimal solution is something in the middle. It's a combination, right? I'm going to have some curtailment because it's not going to be cost-effective to build storage to absorb every last megawatt hour, but I'm going to have some storage and I'm going to have some other solutions. And the portfolio of solutions depends on the cost and the characteristics of those solutions that are available to you. Okay. So, you know, the backdrop, this is kind of a backdrop to our study, because the benefit of something like regional integration, you know, it provides a lot of these services, but without that investment cost. Like, you don't have to spend a lot of, you know, billions of dollars on batteries when you have, if you have renewable a regional market that can help you provide some of these services. Yeah, question?
Yeah, Carl Zakella with NRDC. Arnie, is this assuming that all the storage is in-state and we're not assuming any storage in the rest of the web?
Yeah, that's actually kind of a complicated question. We've assumed a certain amount of storage in-state, which I'll show you a little bit later on. There is storage available, obviously, also elsewhere in the West, but what the model really kind of does is it relies on the rest of the Western grid as a battery. You know, just the fact that there's loads and resources and diversity available across this broad region. And this is basically what Denmark does, right? Denmark, you know, sits in between the big hydro storage facilities in Norway and the big giant European grid, and it kind of, you know, dumps off its surplus wind to the north and to the south, depending on how market conditions, you know, are acting at that time. This gives California some ability to do something like that.
That makes a lot of sense. So just curious, because there are some proposals for strategically located storage elsewhere in the West that California can take advantage of in a regional setting.
Yeah, man. Maybe if you could turn off your mic if you aren't speaking, we'll get some feedback. It's Matt Friedman.
Yeah, Matt Friedman on behalf of TURN. Two quick questions. One, what assumptions are you making with respect to the ability of existing renewable resources in the WEC to substitute for new build under these scenarios? The assumption appears to be it's all incremental investment. Are you going to look at surplus existing resources that could be redispatched?
Yeah, I mean, that's another really complicated question, because the California utilities themselves already have banks of RECs that they, you know, will be able to expand over a certain number of years to help kind of defer the need for new investment. And we haven't gotten into any assumptions about how big that bank is, either inside of California or outside of California. It's just a big data challenge, and very complicated to think about how they would optimally expend those.
Well, my question is a little different, actually. It's not about the California Utilities Bank. For example, in Utah, there's a bunch of renewable QFs that are contracting with Rocky Mountain Power. What if those simply resold to the California utilities? Are you going to look at assumptions around surpluses of existing generation not currently under contract to the California IOUs?
Yeah, I mean, I have a slide that addresses exactly that issue, so let me come back to that.
Okay, my second question is, what assumptions are you making about the ability of the load-serving entities in California to max out on their product content category 2 and 3 allocation under the RPS program, under a business-as-usual scenario?
Yeah, another good question. We have, you know, a number of out-of-state resources available in all three cases. Which, again, let's come back to that after I get to that slide.
I know we're getting a little background noise, so if you can turn your mic off if you're not using them, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Hey, Arnie. Rachel Gold, the Large Scale Solar Association. I wanted to go back one slide and just ask you, how many draws does this model do? You said it's a subset of days.
Oops.
Sorry. I think it
was... I went back, but then I messed up the display. So your question was, what's the subset of days?
How many
days? Yeah. So we're modeling 37 days here that have been kind of carefully selected, and weights are applied to those so that those 37 days represent kind of the distribution of net load conditions that you would expect to see under 50% in California.
I have a quick question following up on that one. And then you're modeling 1 year out of five?
Then we're modeling at 2015, 2020, 2025, and 2030 snapshots minimizing costs over that 15-year period.
Okay, so those 37 days effectively represent 5 years?
Yeah, it's a different, each year, that's basically what it is. Each period, we simulate the operations of those days, and then we bring in the renewable cost information. These operations are there to help understand the value of the renewable resources in the marketplace with respect to displacing fuel, And with respect to the other solutions that are needed, really the bulk of the issue is what are the resources cost and what's their quality. But this gets to the value side of the equation.
Okay, so my real question was about doing the fuel versus capital trade-off, and how are you dealing with capital costs? Are you annualizing them? Are you doing some kind of TRR equivalent? Are you taking them as lump sums?
Yeah, I have a slide on that, so let's come back to that one as well.
Okay, because so far you had just said capital up to 2030, and of course capital investments will last well beyond 2030.
Yeah, they have an economic lifetime as far after that, yeah, absolutely. So let's come back to that. Yes.
Good morning, Will Mitchell from Recurrent Energy. Would you mind going back one slide, please? I think it might be slide 10. Can you articulate on what you mean by generators are compensated regardless of market prices?
I mean, I think what this gets to is thermal generators are assumed to have enough compensation to stay in operation. It gets to kind of the missing money question, that they're assumed that they can make enough margin that they can continue to operate, although we haven't gone through and actually made those calculations. There's no explicit kind of retirement calculation in there.
Okay, so the assumption is that generators are operating under contracts and not in the market as merchants?
Yeah, either that there's enough margin available if they're operating as merchant to cover their fixed O&M, or that they have some contract that helps them with that, that gives them enough revenue to stay in operation. Otherwise, we'd have to go through a whole retirement calculation and understand how many of the thermal generators are going to go offline. That affects what the model might want to build.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so there on slide 21 now, there are a number of different solution types that are considered in the optimization. One I haven't mentioned here is different renewable resources, wind, solar, geothermal, in different locations with different output profiles. It's also considering things like energy storage, 1 hour, 2 hour, 8 hour batteries, pump storage, 12 hour, 24 hour batteries. I can consider demand response programs, new flexible gas generators. Can also be selected, and of course the default solution again is dispatching the renewables and overbuilding the renewable portfolio to make up for the lost production. This just shows you quickly a zonal topology for our operations. So for our operations modeling, we're looking at four zones throughout the West: the CalISO zone, the Northwest zone, which includes the Northern California Balancing Authorities Bank and Turlock. And the Southwest zone, which includes IID, and we actually have LADWP modeled as its own zone. So this, again, is really just for operations. This is understanding if I add a wind resource in a given location, which generators are going to respond to that, and what are the fuel savings going to be from that. We have a greater resolution with respect to where the renewable resources are. Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, Matt Friedman with Turn again. Does that mean you're assuming that there would be no, for example, wind power located in Canada or in the Rocky Mountain region there that could participate in satisfying the RPS requirements of California load-serving entities?
Yeah, we've modeled, as I'll show you, we've modeled Wyoming wind and New Mexico wind as kind of the proxy for out-of-state resources. Now, the best out-of-state resources that could be available for California ratepayers under a West-wide integration scenario. So there is enough high-quality wind represented in scenario three that sort of gray block there doesn't really have any impact.
But you're not looking at British Columbia wind, for example?
We are not looking at British Columbia wind.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Just another section here on data input for our load growth assumptions. You know, really throughout this section, we've tried to rely on the same data that are being used for state planning processes kind of across the board. There's been a lot of effort made over the last several years to unify the assumptions that are used by the Energy Commission and the Public Utilities Commission and the CalISO, and we're trying to use as many of those assumptions as we can and varying them only as is needed and useful for this study. So our load growth forecast comes from the most recent one that was available when we started the study, which was the 2013 IPER. The dashed black line shows the load growth 0.4% per year. We've added some electric vehicle load out towards the end of the next decade to reflect the other aspects of the governor's plans. All of the scenarios start with the same base of resources that are under contract today. And this slide 25 shows you that this is almost enough to meet the 33% RPS for the utilities that are in the CAISO area. And those are then kept constant throughout all the analysis. I'll also add that there are 14.6 gigawatts of rooftop PV assumed as part of all these portfolios. This might actually be a little bit low based on the most recent decision from the PUC, but this is what was consistent in the latest IPER. And so these are also there and present under all the scenarios, although they don't count towards the RPS. The conventional generator additions in Resolve have been taken really mostly directly from the LTPP assumptions in 2014, with one big exception, which is that we're assuming that Diablo Canyon retires in 2025. So this is one of a number of assumptions that we've made, really to try to be conservative about what the impacts of regional integration might be. If this big baseload resource were there and available and operating all the time, then this would actually tend to increase the benefits of regional coordination because it would make the renewable integration challenge harder if California were doing it on its own. We've opted to retire it here. The in-state resource potential comes largely from the data that was developed for the RPS calculator. So this was developed by Black & Veatch, who are EPC contractors to a lot of renewable projects all throughout the West and really around the world and are very knowledgeable in this area. With respect to how much potential is available, for solar, there's effectively unlimited potential. There's really no practical limit on how much solar you could develop in California. Almost anywhere you go, you can build a solar plant and get a reasonable capacity factor and a reasonable price these days, given the cost reductions that we've seen. But, as you get closer and closer to 50%, the model adds a higher and higher premium to resource diversity. The ability to add something besides solar becomes at more and more of a premium. And the ability to diversify the portfolio is relatively limited inside of California. So California has 1,800 megawatts of geothermal potential reflected in the Black & Veatch supply curves. There is some wind potential, class 2 wind in the kind of Northern California, Sacramento River area. But the more we look at that resource, the more difficult, we hear more and more stories about how difficult that's going to be to develop. So we've limited the wind in-state to 3,000 megawatts. This is very consistent with, comments that we've heard from CalWEA and others who are very familiar with wind development in California. This just gives you, slide 28, just gives you a little bit of a snapshot of how those zones are aggregated inside of California. So we have 11 renewable resource zones where we have solar and wind and geothermal available. Okay, out-of-state resources now. So, when we developed the first RPS calculator back in 2008, right, utilities were procuring, there was Oregon wind and Idaho wind that was being procured. We had to find a way then to, think about how we can make out-of-state resources available when we don't really know whether how much existing transmission capacity is available for those resources, what the ability of the other regions would be to absorb those wind resources. With the most recent version of the calculator, because there has been no procurement of out-of-state resources by the IOUs, this was really something that, wasn't on the radar. None of the stakeholders asked for it, and we really focused largely on in-state resources. For the purpose of this study in particular, we didn't want to just say, it's only in-state if we don't have a regional market. We wanted to say, no, there is some ability to go out of state. And even though they haven't been doing it recently, it's kind of a new ballgame going from 33% to 50%. So, what is a reasonable assumption about how much out-of-state wind and solar could be available to California resources under even that business-as-usual case? So after much discussion within the team, these are the assumptions that we've come up with, and we're definitely interested in your comments about this, is that we've assumed that resources that are used for, the energy is used for local needs in another area, let's say Oregon or New Mexico or Arizona, but the RECs could be stripped off and made available to California for compliance purposes. This kind of gets back to Matt's question earlier. We've assumed that there's effectively 2,000 megawatts of that type of resource available somewhere around the West in all three of the scenarios. Okay, now a second category is we've assumed that there are additional 3,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources that would be delivered to California under the product, under PCC 1, but over the existing transmission system. So you wouldn't have to build new transmission to bring this energy to California. You can do it over the existing system with wheeling and losses and losses that apply. And we've assumed there's 3,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources in this category for a total of 5,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources available under all three of the scenarios, even under the business as usual. Okay, so then for category three is now resources that require new transmission for delivery to California or even local loads. And, you know, this represents to us the potential to go out and get really the best and highest quality wind resources in the Rockies area, which is very difficult to do under a business as usual case. And we've made 6,000 megawatts of resources from New Mexico and Wyoming, high quality resources available only in scenarios two and, or only in scenario three, I should say. Yeah.
Hi, Bill DiCapo, DiCapo Legal Advisors. I was just curious what you consider to be new transmission. Is that stuff that's in the pipeline, things that are pending approval, or just things in the abstract that are considered?
Yeah, it's a little more, you know, there are a number of different, projects that are out there looking for sponsors. Some of them would take the energy and deliver it all the way to the California border. Some of them would be more like Gateway that might deliver some of it locally. It might allow it to kind of fan out across the West. So what we've assumed here is more of the latter. And if you really had a regional market, you wouldn't need to build transmission to deliver that energy all the way to California unless the production cost benefits were high enough to justify that. If there are thermal resources that could be displaced in other regions, that might limit the amount of transmission that you have to build to something smaller than a big giant DC pipe that comes from Wyoming 1,000 miles all the way to California.
My question is a little more focused, and that is, were you looking at things that were currently permitted or under permitting process? It sounds like you're looking more expansive than that.
Yeah, I mean, we looked at all the projects that are out there. We're very familiar with all of them. We had to find some that are kind of representative of these 6,000 megawatts of resources. And so we kind of looked at the cost of all the ones that are proposed, including the more local ones, and picked some numbers that we thought were reasonable with respect to the transmission cost. We don't have the geographic resolution in the model that we have to pick between, you know, Gateway or Transwest or any of the other, you know, Zephyr or any of the other projects that, you know, had to go from a specific point A to a specific point B. Yeah.
Carrie Bentley, Rosero Consulting. Can you just clarify whether the 6,000 megawatts is added to scenario 2 and 3 or just 3?
Yeah, this is a typo, actually. I just noticed that as I was talking, that it's actually only scenario 3. Yeah, thank you for that question. Yeah, Jim?
What did you assume? I'm sorry, Jim Caldwell, CERT. What did you assume about repowering of existing wind in California?
We have basically assumed that all existing resources are recontracted. So we haven't assumed, you know, a big swath of new, you know, Altamont Pass, for example, that capacity gets uprated. Although, you know, within that 3,000 megawatts of in-state wind that's available, I would expect a large chunk of it to come from exactly those kind of projects. Yeah, Jan?
Yes, Jan Splendid Jones from IEP. I've got two solar-related questions. The slide 19, which shows that the solar potential is nearly unlimited, I think would be news to any utility-scale developer of solar in the state, given the fact that the DRCP has already limited a significant amount of land, and there appears to be additional environmental constraints being imposed upon the solar market in general. Is that being taken into consideration anywhere in the modeling?
I mean, let me just give you a couple numbers here. So I think our number of that's in the RPS calculator for how many megawatts of solar is available is 100,000 megawatts. And Black & Veatch took out 95% of the theoretical potential to get down to that 100,000 megawatt limit. So, you know, there's just an enormous amount of solar potential available right now. When you get to any specific area, there's land use issues, there's, you know, neighbors that might not like that kind of development, there's all kinds of, environmental issues. You know, we're not seeing, from where I sit, I'm not seeing solar availability being a constraint on California hitting a 50% RPS or any other level beyond that that you can imagine from the statewide perspective. Certainly in local areas, it can be a real issue.
That's good news. The second question I have is with respect to the rooftop PV slide. This is slide 17. What went into the calculation? I think there's 4,000 megawatts right now, or 4 gigawatts of rooftop PV now, and you're estimating almost 15 by 2030. What went into that?
I think this is in the IPER, right? In the latest IPER, load forecast.
In the IPER, okay.
This amount of.
And then last but not least, I assume currently that rooftop solar is not curtailable, unlike the utility scale solar. Is that assumption carry here as well? That is 15,000.
Yeah, we're not reaching into the rooftop stack to curtail it. We haven't seen that need because there's enough central station stuff that we're assuming is curtailable. You know, in Hawaii, they're starting to get to pretty close to that point where there's enough rooftop that's more than the load they have on some of the smaller islands.
Okay.
We haven't seen that yet for California in any of the cases that we've run.
Thank you.
Yes.
Travis Ritchie with the Sierra Club. In the modeling on the assumptions for existing resources, and particularly the thermal resources, it looks like all of the retirement assumptions were hard-coded. Is the model capable of selecting inefficient resources and taking them out?
In theory, yes, it is capable of doing that. It's not a functionality that it requires a look ahead, right? Market revenue estimate of here's my fixed cost, here's the capital return I need to have on that asset to keep it alive, here's my hurdle, right? Here's what the market looks like for that kind of a resource. In theory, it's capable of doing that, but we haven't implemented that functionality here.
Ernie?
Yeah.
This is Keith. I think it's been a good Q&A session, but we are trying to stay on track with the agenda. So what I would ask is, could you complete your presentation? Let's hold off any questions until you get through it.
Sounds good. Okay, so slide 30 just kind of gives you a table of out-of-state resource availability by scenario, and you can see scenarios 1 and 2, we've assumed the same availability. Effectively, these are, if we don't change our procurement policies, we have the same resources available to us. We're testing just the benefit of the operations between those two scenarios. And scenario 3 is if we change our procurement policy and look to potentially lower cost out-of-state resources. Next few slides are on renewable resource costs. We could have a long discussion about this. I'll mention that these are the costs from RPS calculator version 6.1, and there's lots of material out there available on those costs. There is a pro forma cash flow model, so we take the investment cost and we annualize that, and it's the annualized number that's used in the optimization. We do have site-specific output profiles. So this slide shows, slide 32 shows output profiles from 4 different wind resources in Wyoming, New Mexico, the Tehachapi area, and the Solano area in California. It's interesting, you know, the Solano has a kind of a typical coastal wind pattern to it. It blows like crazy in the afternoon and at night in the summertime, very still most of the rest of the year. Tehachapi has kind of a similar pattern, but it's not quite as pronounced as Solano is. Wyoming and New Mexico have, you know, very interesting kind of, you know, round-the-clock high levels of production in the wintertime and lower production in the summer. We used to think this was a bad match for California because it doesn't match our loads very well. But once you've added tens of thousands of megawatts of solar to the California grid, this profile starts to look a lot more attractive because it gives you a lot of energy during times when you're not already curtailing due to overgeneration in California. Okay, these are just kind of a sample of the PPA prices that come out of the model for a delivery in 2015. We have solar between kind of $68 and $82 a megawatt hour. This is levelized over a 20-year period. And wind is between $60 and $85 a megawatt hour in California. The geothermal costs increased a lot between version 6.0 and version 6.1 of the calculator. And right now they're coming in at something like $116 a megawatt hour, which really puts them out of the market. Now there's a lot of uncertainty about the geothermal costs. They're very, very site specific, dependent on the resource quality in a given area, depending on the contamination with metals and other things in a given area. So we don't have a crystal ball on that. And there may very well be projects that can come in much lower than this and still get PPAs in California. This is just kind of a modeling exercise. Slide 34 just kind of gives you a sense of the regional variation in the quality and the price of solar. Sort of the best resources are in the desert area at kind of 33%, 34% capacity factor. Those, as of now, the model is showing those at about $68 a megawatt hour for California. And, you know, kind of the lowest quality resources that are in the model are in the Solano area. Even those are, you know, 28% capacity factor and $80 a megawatt hour. So this price spread between the desert and the Central Valley solar has really compressed a lot over the last several years. And there's not nearly as much of a premium as there used to be on finding the absolute best solar resources. Slide 35 shows the wind, and there is a much bigger variation in wind quality. And since diversity is at such a premium, as we go to 50% in California, these differences in wind quality become very important drivers of model results. All the resources that's available in California is, you know, largely in that kind of mid to high 20% capacity factor. You know, the model has a little bit of better wind in the Tehachapi and Imperial areas, but again, everyone that we've talked to that's experiencing wind development talks about how difficult it is to develop these resources in California. And even at best, they're in that kind of $60 a megawatt hour range. In Wyoming and New Mexico, the resources are very high quality, and we're showing them in kind of the low 40% capacity factor range. It's much cheaper to build there as well, because it's not steep ridge lines that you're building on. It's a lot of kind of rolling, you know, plains, high plains kind of terrain, so it's much cheaper to build the resources there. And we're showing the Wyoming and New Mexico wind kind of in the mid $30, $34, $36 per megawatt hour. Yeah, Matt, quick question?
Yeah, Matt Friedman again. What assumptions are you making with respect to the new transmission scenario you've identified there for Wyoming and New Mexico? Are those the PacifiCorp Gateway projects, or are those different transmission upgrades that are designed to allow import of the energy deliverability essentially to California?
Yeah, that's a good question, and you know, we haven't tied these to any specific project. I'd say, you know, we've really developed dollar per kilowatt kind of estimates, you know, based on looking at a whole bunch of different projects, including ones that are more local than that, but like that, and including ones that are longer. And I would say they're closer to the gateway costs than they are to like the Transwest Express costs, which require, you know, 1,000 miles of new corridor.
Are those $34 and $38 prices, including the cost of transmission, or those are just generator costs?
Just the generator costs, yeah.
But for those projects, the transmission would be incremental, so you would have to have that cost as well.
Transmission is on top of this, and yes, the model requires, to get to that really the best quality wind in Wyoming and New Mexico, the model requires new transmission to be built.
And what's the basis for assuming that you can't have new transmission to either Wyoming or New Mexico under scenarios 1 and 2?
You know, those resources have been out there for a long time. You know, for the last 10 or 15 years, there have been studies about how there'd be benefits to California ratepayers if you were to, you know, build a 1,000-mile transmission line out there to Wyoming to get this very high-quality wind. You know, despite those studies being out there, it's just been very, very difficult to string together the political, you know, deals necessary to go across 4 states. You know, to get those corridors sited. And, you know, the other issue is that when you're trying to deliver the energy all the way from a remote area to California, those have to come in really 3,000 megawatt chunks, you know, 1,500 to 3,000 megawatt chunks to be economic. And it's just been very difficult to find enough buyers in the California end to sponsor a big giant project like that. It's not to say that it's impossible, but we haven't seen anything really like that. There's been a lot of candidates and no takers for them over the last, 10 or 15 years. So to me, it's very, very difficult to make that happen without some type of a regional entity that has a region-wide look on transmission planning and transmission costs.
So the assumption is because it hasn't happened, that's why it wouldn't happen. Not that the prices might be wrong.
In the interest of moving things along, I think Arnie tried to explain a host of other reasons why it might not happen, besides it not happening historically. So let's move on and again try to save the questions to the very end.
PPA prices change over time due to technology improvements and due to changes in the tax code, and we factored all that into the model as well. We have batteries and other storage devices in the model as well that are selected in some cases depending on how challenging the integration issues are. In slide 30, it kind of shows you the trajectories of those. We've assumed pretty aggressive cost reductions for batteries as well. All right. I'm going to move on to slide 41 now and start walking you through what the portfolios look like based on all the assumptions that we've just talked about. So slide 41 is a little bit of an intro to that. It's a reminder of what our three scenarios are, what our export limits are in each of the three scenarios. And I'll just note here that even though geothermal and pump storage weren't being selected in any of the cases in our model, that we've added them to all three scenarios just to make sure that we're reflecting a diverse portfolio of renewables in our business as usual case and, to make sure that, to reflect the interest, the continued interest in pump storage locally. So both of these assumptions tend to reduce the overall benefit that you might expect to see from moving to regional integration because they are the same across all three of those cases. Slide 42 shows the resources that are common to all the cases, to all of the scenarios to meet the 33% RPS. And I want to walk you through every line in the table here, but just to harken back to some of our previous discussions, what we see in the portfolio to meet 33% is about 17,500 megawatts of resources that are local inside California and about 3,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources. So, is our assumption of 5,000 megawatts of resources available to go from 33 to 50% reasonable? When I look at this, it seems kind of reasonable to me, but again, that's where we're looking for feedback on that. And again, we have the 14,600 megawatts of behind-the-meter PV, which does have an impact. Okay, so in the next slide are all a bunch of tables. So rather than walk you through this on one table, you can study them in your spare time, but we have some slides to kind of just walk you through what some of the key changes are. So this first table is just all of our categories across all the scenarios, stated in megawatts. And slide 44 shows you all of the resources across all the categories stated in gigawatt hours. The one thing I'll point out on this slide is that the bottom line total varies by scenario. Okay, and that's because of curtailment. There's curtailment in all of these scenarios. There's more curtailment in scenario one. There's the least curtailment in scenario three. But what we're showing you here is that the available gigawatt hours from all the resources that were built across all the portfolios. So there is some curtailment. These have all been overbuilt to reflect the amount of curtailment that the model is finding. Okay, so just to walk you through in scenario one, the effect of those three alternatives. Okay, now remember the only difference between the three is what's the export limit? How much are you assuming you can export from California at any given point in time? Scenario 1A is 2,000 megawatts, 1B is 5,000 megawatts, 1C is 8,000 megawatts. So this does have an impact on the least cost portfolio that the model picks in scenario 1. You can see moving from 1A to 1B, you actually have an increase in the amount of solar that the model picks and a decrease in the amount of out-of-state wind. Effectively, scenario 1A is more constrained. The more that you constrain the exports from California, the more detrimental it is to the economics of new solar investments in California, and the higher premium the model places on any kind of diversity. So you can see in 1A, it's picking the northwest wind RECs, and the northwest wind over existing transmission. If we were to relax that export assumption a little bit up to 5,000 megawatts, it gets rid of the northwest wind and buys more California solar. Then the difference between scenario 1A or 1B and 1C, you can see everything's the same except for the amount of California solar that's built. We're building less California solar in scenario 1C than we are in 1B. Well, why are we building less solar? Because we have less curtailment. So effectively, the wind resources in the Northwest are the marginal resource that the model builds to make up for the lost, that's the overbuild to make up for the lost production. First thing it does is get rid of that. The second thing it does, it just delivers more, a larger proportion of the solar, doesn't have to overbuild by quite as much. Okay, now comparing scenario 1A to scenario 2. In scenario 2 now has 8,000 megawatts of export capability. It has west-wide operations. It has D-pancakes transmission rates. So the first thing, again, that it does is it, because we have now a freer flowing power across a much larger, more diverse western grid, again, it wants to reduce the amount of wind that it builds in California because it's more expensive, and it wants to pick more solar. So it's interesting, if we just go to west-wide operations, don't change the procurement policies in California, what you see actually is a slight increase in the amount of solar that's built in California and a slight decrease in the amount of wind. So these are relatively, small impacts. So at the end, we'll get to, at the end of the study, we'll understand how much the cost savings are associated with these changes in the portfolio. And then moving to scenario 3, this is now where we see the biggest changes. If we allow the model to select those from those 6,000 megawatts of high-quality wind in New Mexico and Wyoming, it wants to pick 1,500 megawatts of each, effectively. And that, again, reduces the amount of wind that's developed in California and reduces the amount of solar that's built in California.
Question?
And then slide 48 just kind of sums it all up in chart form. You can see the different scenarios 1 and scenario 2, there's not a huge a difference in the portfolio. A little more solar in scenario 2. In scenario 3 now, it's about, the new investment is about 50-50. It's about half California and half resources that are developed in the rest of the West.
Question?
And then these are, just again a reminder, if you haven't already thought of some things to ask or some things to give us feedback on, here are some suggested ideas. So. Yeah, go ahead.
Dave Marcus, consultant for Q. A few slides back, you had results where in scenario 3, it was procuring 1,500 megawatts of new Wyoming wind that requires new transmission. And a few minutes before that, I thought you were saying that there were lumpiness issues. Can you get only 1,500, or are you required to get all 3,000 or none?
Yeah, the question, if you couldn't hear it, was about the lumpiness of the out-of-state transmission. That's a great question. We've went through some discussions about how lumpy we should make these out-of-state resource bundles. I mean, the reality is if you have a single transmission operator over the entire western area, there's going to be 200 megawatts here, 300 megawatts there, 500 megawatts there that you can add without triggering a large new lumpy transmission investment. So we've simplified that a little bit by bundling the out-of-state resources into 1,500 megawatt bundles. That's probably really overly restrictive if you think about how it might really play out if you had a single west-wide transmission tariff and a single transmission operator over such a broad area. Yeah, Rachel?
Yeah, Rachel Gold with the Large Scale Solar Association. A couple of questions. First, going back a few slides on the solar costs. I understand that's a 2015 installed cost, but when I looked at your learning curves, I'm not sure it's catching up with what we're seeing today. So something to think about there. And the second thing is, I thought I saw on one of the slides that you assume no extension of the ITC. I just want to clarify what that assumption is.
Yeah, I think actually the slide is outdated.
Okay.
Because we reflected the changes that happened in Congress in December.
Okay. And then finally, we have been seeing some procurement out of state mm-hmm. in the last year by the utilities. So we may want to think about, in terms of the business as usual scenario, how to reflect that a little better, because we are already seeing some Southwest solar and some other wind.
Let me see if I go back to the slide where we assume the availability. I mean, that's been a very interesting development that we've observed as well, and I think the market's already placing a premium on diversity and finding wind resources where it can. But that's exactly why we've assumed in scenario one that there's that 5,000 megawatts available. Okay. So this reflects the fact that there's limited recent activity and potentially some more of that in the future. And is 5,000 megawatts the right number? Is it 7,000? Is it 3,000? We don't know, right?
Yeah, I would just say that I appreciate your optimism about the viability of solar in California, but I think we are seeing a little bit more outside of the state because of some of the challenges.
Thank
you. Arnie, this is Keith. I'm going to be very unpopular here, and I know there's a lot of questions around the portfolio, but we need to cover other aspects of the study methodology. And again, we've allotted an hour at the end of the day. So if you could just bear with us to get through the other material, and we can resume the Q&A on the portfolios later today. But I know we have one participant on the phone who's been waiting a while, and we'd like to get to her question, and then we'll move on to the next question.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, Tegan, I know Julia was in the queue. She did lower her hand. So, Julia, if you still have a question, you go ahead and press pound 2 to enter the queue.
And this is Debbie Levine. While she's queuing up the speaker on the phone, also a reminder, we did put out a stakeholder template, so we're looking for written comments from stakeholders. To the extent that we don't answer your question or you have additional questions, if you could go ahead and add that into the stakeholder template, which will be due back to the ISO on February the 19th, that would be fabulous. Thanks.
All right. Tegan, did Julia re-enter the queue?
Yes, she did.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Hello, this is Julia May from Communities for a Better Environment. Thank you. So I thought you said earlier that the assumptions you were using were 2013 IPER, and I was curious if that includes the 2014 million electric vehicle by 2023 assumptions, and there are also additional assumptions in language in SB 350, assuming widespread vehicle electrification and consistent with 40% greenhouse gas cuts by 2030. So it seems like charging electric vehicles during the day is one of the scenarios that E3 has talked about in other slides, but I didn't see anything in here where you address those assumptions. And how you use electric vehicle charging to balance solar.
Yeah, no, thank you for the question. We do have quite a lot of electric vehicles in our assumptions for load growth. Back on slide 24, you can see it adds about 0.4% per year average annual by the time you get out to 2030. We haven't made an assumption that those can be flexibly charged, but we have used a profile for charging of those vehicles that's relatively friendly to the solar integration needs. Now, there's a lot of questions about just how flexible vehicle charging can be made given people's need for transport services. But yeah, thanks for the question.
So you don't have the million electric vehicle assumption in your as being available for charging in these assumptions, but the 2023 numbers.
Yeah, we can certainly get the number to you as to how many vehicles we're assuming by 2030. I know it's quite a large electrification load. And again, we've assumed charging patterns that are, you know, friendly to the integration issues that we're observing on the grid.
Okay, thank you, Arnie.
Thank you. I'd like to